This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup. This season of True Tales of Luxury is proudly sponsored by Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.
I wanted to be part of that world. It looked so luxurious and glamorous. A kind of world that I had never seen before. I mean, I thought someone was very wealthy if they didn't live in a council house, you know?
In this series of podcasts, I'm talking to people at the forefront of the creative industries about their life and work and their relationship to luxury. Today, I'm with Sam McKnight. This hairstylist has a four-decade-long career in one of the most fickle arenas in the world, the fashion industry. He's created looks for the catwalk, for editorial and advertising campaigns, worked with the most famous and the most beautiful women in the world, and indeed, the most successful and creative photographers. Truly, he has actually surfed the trickiest clients you possibly could over a four-decade period. Vivienne Westwood says that Sam McKnight makes women into goddesses. Well, Sam, you'd have your work cut out for you with me. Welcome to the penthouse here at Harrods, which is rather glamorous, though probably not nearly as glamorous as the salons you normally waft through.
You would be very surprised. I've just been in it. Well, thank you for that amazing introduction, by the way. That was the best ever. I don't waft through salons. We kind of troll 20 bags through backstage areas that are sometimes smaller than this very small room.
But you were quite a pioneer, weren't you? You know, nowadays, I think there are probably quite a lot of stylists, hairstylists who work only on, you know, photographic sessions and editorial and, you know, that sort of thing. But I think back when you were starting, there were few and far between.
There were very few. I did my first photo shoots in 77, I think.
So young.
I worked in a salon called Moulton Brown. Moulton Brown, the brand began as the hippest, coolest hair salon in UK, really, in London. It was great. It was amazing. Long story short, they'd send me out on photo shoots if someone wasn't available. One of the bigger hairdressers wasn't available or someone was sick. So I got thrown in the deep end, and Vogue was one of my first shoots. So it kind of all started there. And I very quickly made a decision that that's what I wanted to do and not work in a salon. Because before that, ex-models like Joanna Lumley and people like that often say, and Twiggy will often say, that they did their own hair and makeup on shoots.
That's amazing, isn't it?
I was there at the right time, just after that, late 70s.
Now, unlike a lot of people you might talk to, I've been to New Cumnock in Ayrshire, or at least driven through it on the way to where my mum lives. And that's where you were born you grew up. And it's a mining town in the middle of nowhere. It's not the sort of place that you would necessarily imagine a sort of pioneer of the fashion industry to come from. And I wondered what had inspired you as a kid, or what you were like as a kid, and whether the idea of becoming a hairstylist was in any way on your sort of consciousness at that time.
No, it was absolutely wasn't at all. I had a very, very happy outdoor childhood on basically a council estate in the middle of the most beautiful countryside and hills in the south of Scotland. And I guess looking back, we had an idyllic doors open all the time. We were chucked out at 8 o'clock in the morning in summer and came back when it was dark at 11:30 at night. We were probably regarded as feral now, but it seemed idyllic to me. It was great, and it's still lovely. I go back there all the time.
But it's a tough place as well, and it's not.
It's a tough place.
You know,
yeah,
it's a mining town,
and it's even tougher now because of the unemployment and that kind of thing. But it's in one of the most beautiful parts of the country. It's lovely, and I love going home. It's great. I still call it home.
So what was your ambition? Because it wouldn't have been Vogue.
Well, I didn't really have an ambition. I was quite clever at school, and there were high hopes for me. I ended up going to teacher training college. And as I got into my late teens and up towards 20, I realized I hated being at school. I hated studying. I hated the whole thing. Like, what am I going to do? Because I can't bear this. I couldn't stand it. I mean, I was really into David Bowie, fashion, platform shoes, all that kind of stuff was just happening. I went on holiday to London a couple of times, and I just thought, okay, I need to expand my horizons. And my friends owned a hairdressing salon in Ayr. And I ended up by accident helping them out in the hairdressing salon and started doing hair. And it all happened so quickly and absolutely by accident, and I really enjoyed it. And then a year or two later, I found myself in London looking for a job. And luckily, I ended up at Molton Brown, who were doing all the photo shoots for Vogue. I mean, I kind of did look at who did the hair in Vogue.
You slightly hunted them down, didn't you?
I did hunt them down. I did hunt them down, yes. They were the guys doing all the coolest stuff. And I thought, I'm going to go and try and get a job there. I'm kind of like that. I pushed my way in.
Sometimes
and you know what? I had the best 3 years there. It was great. And I still to this day see a lot of the people that I used to work with. I think we had a lot of fun.
You said that you'd sort of worked in the salon in Ayr and you thought, oh, I quite like this. Mm. What was it that you liked? What was it that first, you know,
okay. My dad worked in a coal mine and my mum worked in the local co-op till she was 60 something, you know, and she's 87 now. So, you know, she worked most of her life, you know, but we didn't have any money. So if I wanted any money, I had to earn it myself. School holiday, I worked in a sock factory, a jeans factory. But my first real job was I would clean windows, and I walked around those bleak winter days up there with a
it can wooden, be very great.
Carrying a wooden ladder. I mean, you were near the coast, weren't you?
I was in the hills.
Oh, you were
at
in the hills.
Bar,
okay,
yeah.
We're in the hills, and it rains all the time, yeah, pretty much. Basically. Even on a sunny day, it's raining.
I once took a whole August off to spend the summer holidays there, and that was a mistake.
So I had a chamois leather and a bucket and a wooden ladder and some newspaper and vinegar that I used to carry around and clean windows on my council estate. And I can still tell you the names of the people who lived in the houses, and I'll still argue with people. No, she doesn't live there. She lived there.
No.
I can still do that, yeah. Anyway, so I did that, and working in a salon was definitely not that. It was suddenly, okay, so this is not really...
It
was a luxury job. It was so luxurious compared to what I had done. There you go.
And that was it, really?
And that was it. That was the thing that hooked me. Weirdly, in our school, I don't know why up there, they had old Vogue magazines, and I remember being kind of quite captivated by Norman Parkinson's pictures. Norman Parkinson and Helmut Newton and people like that, and it wasn't for a while later that I kind of put it all together and thought, you could actually do this. I wanted to be part of that world, you know.
What was it about that world?
I don't know. It just looked so glamorous. I mean, it looked so luxurious and glamorous. A kind of world that I had never seen before, you know. I mean, I thought someone was very wealthy if they didn't live in a council house, you know. And I think that's what people look to magazines like that for.
Fantasy.
Yes. Yeah. It's aspirational, you know. Mm.
Do you know, I used to walk down South Moulton Street and I moved to London in 1979 and I used to walk down South Moulton Street every morning and, I used to dream of going into Molton Brown's and having my hair done. And you've talked before about the transformative power of hair. Why do you think hair plays such a major role in so many women's lives and I think increasingly men?
There's many reasons. I think it can be many different things. It can be an armor. It can be something you hide behind, hence a long fringe. You know, it can be something you hide behind. It can be something that you treat like a pair of Manolo Blahnik shoes. It's your kind of crowning glory. You kind of embrace it and you embellish it. Different people will experiment with the hair and change it every 6 weeks. I think there's so many different reasons why it's important. But the great thing about it is it grows back. So you can actually, when people get sort of panicked about a haircut, they say, don't worry about it. You know, in a month, it'll have turned into something else. It's only hair. It will grow back.
Well, it's interesting you say that because one of the things I was most struck by reading through your clippings, and I am sort of fast-forwarding forward, so we'll probably go backwards and forwards, was you talk about, I'm not sure if it was the first time, I doubt it was the first time that you worked with Princess Diana, but you talked about a particular session, and I think it was at the height of the sort of various troubles that she was going through, and she said to you, if you could do anything to my hair right now, what would you do? Which is a very leading question for a woman, you know.
Well, I remember that really well. That was the very first time I met her, and it was 1990.
It was the first time.
And we did a shoot with Patrick de Marchelier for Vogue in a little studio in Hackney in the East End. And it was kind of, we didn't know it was going to be her. We weren't told it was going to be her. And I wasn't spending much time in this country around then anyway. I was all over the place and not really that interested in the royals or, you know, not right. not take it uninterested. Or leave them. Yeah. And we had done a few duchesses and princesses and things, portraits of them, and we'd had a lovely day. And we had one more to do it, and this sort of tall, leggy blonde comes bouncing up the stairs and kind of makes us all melt instantly. And we did a few pictures. And one of them was the really famous, I've become iconic now. It was in a white dress sitting on the floor with a huge smile and a big tiara. I now have a fridge magnet with that on it, which is great. Come round many houses with me. It's kind of a bit tattered around the edges. Anyway, so she at the end of the shoot, we had made her hair look a bit short, but I disguised it and kind of for the photo. And she liked the photo and she said, "What would you do?" So I said, "I just cut it all off and start again, you know, just kind of, you know, did you want to do it now?" Said, "Yeah, okay."
Well, come on, you got to have been shocked when she said okay.
No, not really, because that's what I do. I mean, I work with people all the
time. Nobody says okay to a hairdresser they've just met.
Don't they?
No. No, we spend weeks and months building up to, can we get the courage to change?
Speak, you know, for yourself.
I thought that it really reflected something great about her when I read about it, when I read it in your clips. I thought it reflected something really impulsive and great about her, or potentially desperate because it was a bad time. And also something incredibly complimentary about you, because to inspire that much confidence in a very short period of time, I wonder if that's one of your specialist skills.
Oh, I don't know. Probably a mix of all of the above, really. Probably in retrospect now, she had been looking to change for a while, because when you see it looking at the past, we cut it short. I put a plastic bag that a dress had been in around her and sort of cut her hair off. And I've got some lovely pictures from that day too, which are really great. She was very happy. And then I started working with her and we went on for 7 years after that. But I think in retrospect, it was a time for her to change. And I think that's the great thing about hair, is it is transformative and it can help you through a multitude of different times in your life. And I think it's a very small but significant and sort of powerful way to purge yourself and to send out messages that you want to send out, you know? And she started to do lots of things by herself, and she became the sort of power businesswoman of the 90s. And it all works together. The heels got higher, and the hair got smaller, the shoulders toned, the whole thing was toned. I mean, she was going to the gym and toned. So I think it is, it's literally your crowning glory, isn't it, really? And I think it's the transformative power of hair is what I like to call it.
What would you say, I mean, aside from that Diana moment that you've described for me, what would you say have been the most transformative, the most sort of iconic hairstyles that you've created for people, where you've kind of thought, okay, this is maybe a game changer, or realised shortly afterwards that you'd done something quite radical? I think of things like the Angus Dens.
Oh, Agnes, yeah. There was a model in the 2000s.
Early noughties
sometime. There's a model called Agnes Den, who's now quite a successful actress, actually. And she came on a shoot for Vogue with Mario Testino, and she had kind of shoulder-length, mousy hair. And we thought she looked a little bit like an old friend of mine who was a big model in the 80s called Jenny Howarth, whose hair I chopped off and bleached mid-80s in one of those New York nightclub evenings. And
oh, no!
It worked out very well because that transformed her career. We thought she looked a bit like Jenny, and we thought, well, maybe she would look better with short hair. So we just cut her hair off, and then she went off. I think she went to Nicola and had it bleached. And that gave Agnes a massive career after that for quite a few years. So that became quite iconic. At the beginning of Lady Gaga's career, more recently, we did lots of different looks. I actually pinned the steak on her head when she did the MTV Award.
Because she went covered in meat, didn't she?
Covered. She had a meat dress, shoes, purse, and I was handed this steak. We kind of had to pin it to the wig.
But
which was
kind
of
nice.
Great. Well, there were a lot of flies in the dressing room.
You mentioned Mario Testino, and you've worked with some incredible photographers, including Mario, over the years. And I wondered how those collaborations form and what makes for the sort of alchemy that turns it into something, you know, where you keep working together.
This goes from back in the day when there was a model and a photographer. You know, I mean, Bailey married four of his models, you know.
And there were only two of them in the room,
yeah. But now that, I mean, now there's a whole...
SWAT team.
There's a nation in the room, yeah. It's a small town. But back then there would be hair, makeup, and still the core team is the hair, makeup, stylist and photographer. And I hope I'm not missing that right. Nails now too, the nail person. So it's a collaboration. It's a discussion with the model or actress or star, whoever it is. A collaboration of what are we going to achieve? A Vogue cover takes a very different process than, for instance, an ad for lipstick.
You know? How so?
Well, the Vogue cover is, you could probably be a bit more adventurous with it. It's got to sell. So, I mean, they've all got to sell, really. But the lipstick will be focused on the lipstick. The Vogue cover will be focused on the whole thing. They're all trying to convey in one image what they're trying to sell. Vogue will be trying to sell their issue. Lipstick will be trying to sell the color of the lipstick. Mascara will be trying to... a clothing company will be trying to sell a coat, you know, so it's the coat that has to shine and maybe the hair has to take a backdrop. Or the coat might not be so great, so it needs a bit of help. So they've booked... Gigi Hadid and a great hair and makeup team and a great photographer. So it's all selling basically, isn't it? And it's selling an image with Gaga. We did lots of stuff like that. And we did the Born This Way album cover and all the stuff for the onstage performances. There were big screens. And we turned her into a man for us. She had a sort of alternative persona that was, I think she called it Joe Calderon. And we did all that and suddenly it was like, we're in Nick's studio and said, oh, should we do something mannish? So suddenly she was a man in about 20 minutes. Val and I kind of had her, you know, had the wig off, her own hair dyed black, and about 20, with ink, I think we dyed, or some black stuff we found lying around.
What, like any old stuff?
Any old stuff, yeah. It's a bit, I mean, the creative process is very different from each one, you know?
And if I had to ask you that awful question, you know, if you had a favorite photographer that you've worked with or someone,
oh, God.
You know, you've only got happy memories of, or who you think you did your best work with or do your best work with, I'm talking like you're nearly dead, who would it be?
I'm not sure. I couldn't. I mean, I don't have a favorite one. My key photographers are in my life. I've worked with Patrick Dumarchelier for 40 years and with Mario for 20-odd years. With Nick Knight for the last 25 years. And probably my most prolific and my most sort of, I guess, family of a team would be the Nick Knight family. We've done so much for Vogue, my iconic stuff with Kate Moss. And another photographer I work with who's not, maybe people don't know him. I've worked for the last 10 years with Karl Lagerfeld at Chanel and at Fendi and at Karl Lagerfeld. And Karl shot all his own campaigns. Karl was a prolific, wonderful photographer.
And, I didn't know that.
Yeah. All the Chanel campaigns up until, I think, the last one are all Karl's. Not the beauty, the fashion, but I think Karl became another photographer in my roster, and I had an absolutely wonderful time there.
Has there been a point, or can you pinpoint the point when you thought, okay, I am now a part of that world that I used to look in the magazines and think, God, that's where I want to be.
How can I say that without sounding awful? I'm quite shallow, I have discovered in my old age, and I really like that. It keeps me very safe. You know, I skirt around the outside of things and I like being part of that, but I don't like being immersed in it. Am I saying all the right things?
No, I totally understand.
I don't
that.
Like being a victim of it. I like actually working in it. My work is great. I love being there, but I like to leave it behind and and spend time alone in my garden.
So there isn't actually a sense that, but there's two things you're talking about there. One is not feeling that you are a part of this thing, feeling, managing to maintain your own individuality and sense of priority outside of the sort of bubble of you know, the fashion show business world. Yeah. The other is feeling that you've actually achieved what you set out to do, that you've gone on that journey from the small boy and to the adult Sam sitting here, you know.
Yeah. I think, to be honest, I was asked, I guess, about 7 or 8 years ago. I have a massive archive. It would be 8 years ago since I moved the last time. I have a massive archive, a paper archive of cuttings and covers and magazines. I've got the whole magazine four times over sometimes. And they're all in plastic boxes. They were in my flat before. And I thought, now, if anything happens to these, it would be terrible. And things were starting to be digitalized. Well, I started to become aware of it. Probably been happening before then. And I thought, okay, let's get someone to put all this onto
digital whatever,
hard drive,
the cloud.
Yeah, there.
The cloud.
And I found an archivist who did that for me, who was actually amazing. She was incredible. And she happened to work for Somerset House. And she said, would you mind if I, this archive is kind of amazing. Shona Marshall asked if we would like to do an exhibition.
She's the curator there, isn't she? Yeah.
So we spent 2 years actually doing an exhibition, which was really amazing. And we did a book with Rizzoli at the same time. And it's a really beautiful book. It was only then when I started to go and talk to people and do things like this that I'd never really done before. It put it all in some, put the jigsaw sort of in place. And I could see my whole life's work, which kind of became my life. I mean, the memories that would come up were quite extraordinary. It was incredible experience. And it probably was then, and that was 3 years ago, because I thought, oh God, this has been amazing. This has been absolutely fantastic. I've been so lucky. I mean, I always knew I was lucky, and I always knew it's been great. But that was probably when I thought, yeah, okay, it's been good. I've achieved what I wanted to achieve.
You've worked with some incredible people, as you've outlined, and, you know, some of them have come to tragic ends. I mean, lots happens in 40 years, but, you know, you are working with people at the top of their field, you know, and they skirt very close to danger in all kinds of different ways. And hairdressers are the repository of secrets. You know, even if you sit in the salon down the road on a Saturday afternoon, you hear people telling the most indiscreet things to their hairdresser. How do you cope with that side of it? You know, because you must be burdened sometimes with the knowledge of seeing someone come unstuck.
I think probably I have built, I don't know if it's instinctive, but you take it on board to a certain point, but I don't make it my business. Because it's not my business.
Absolutely.
Sense? Quite often you know that someone needs help and you try to help them, but I know now that you can only help someone if they actually want help. And quite often people talking to you and unloading stuff doesn't mean that they want help. It's just unloading stuff, and that's help in itself. Does that make sense? It works the other way around too. I'll unload to them too. I kind of knows who I can unload to and who I can't. It's a mutual exchange, really, isn't it? Really, I mean, the listening and the unloading is mutually beneficial, I think.
Who's the nicest person you've ever worked with?
Oh, I tend to work with nice people. I do. I was saying that to someone the other day. I think that's probably one of the secrets that I've lasted so long. I don't respond well to psychological games and negativity and stress. I discovered that very early on, because early on in my career, I found myself working in a couple of teams of people that thrived on stress, which happens a lot, and that's fine. That's not for me. That's why I'm kind of shallow and flowery, you know, and that suits me. It protects me too, you know.
It's solid and sensible to me. But that's a luxury that you develop over the years, isn't it? Rather than something you have from the beginning. I mean, you now have the luxury of choice, I presume. You can say, I'm not around then. And
you're absolutely right. I mean, choice is a real luxury. I don't have to do a job if I don't want to, and that's one of the most luxurious things you could ever dream of, isn't it? Really, you know.
You've been a gun to hire, really, a gun for hire.
Still am.
For four decades.
Still am.
He's still available.
Still am.
He's still available. Thank goodness for that. But you've also moved into the world of commerce, I would say, because apparently that's where big hairdressers do eventually make their retiring money, though you may well already have made yours, by creating these four products, Hair by Sam McKnight. And yeah, every single one of them sounds like an essential. But, you know, can you tell me a bit about them and why just four products?
I was finding that a lot of products that we use backstage, they involved you wetting the hair, taking a long time, and we don't have the luxury of time backstage. We really are constrained. We sometimes got an hour and a half to do 60, 70, 80 girls. I mean, we have a big team, but, you know, so we need products that were really quick, quick fixes, quick changes, easy to use, brushed out, made the hair look great, boom, on to the next one. And that's why we did these. I call them all brush outable. It's not a word, but we kind of
works.
We may have to trademark that.
I know what you mean.
Well, everyone knows what I mean when I say that. It's totally brush outable. It's not going to make your hair heavy. We have the Cool Girl texture spray, which came from that kind of messy Kate Moss thing we used to use a ton of products to do, but now this one will mess up your hair.
I thought you did that just naturally by going out.
Ah, there you go. That's a way to recreate that, you know, in the studio.
For those of us who don't want to be out all night.
There you go, yeah. And the Easy Updo is a much stronger version of that. And we kept saying it kind of feels like about 20 hairpins in a can. So instead of using 40 pins, you might be able to use two or three. The pins grip to the hair. The blue one is called Lazy Girl. We had a little bit of fun with the names, you know. And Lazy Girl is our dry shampoo. It's almost invisible.
Dry shampoo might not have gone out of fashion on shoots, but it definitely had for a long time.
For a long
sort
time,
of
Kind
of 50s image about it.
In the fashion industry, backstage have never fallen out of love because it's such a quick fix thing. I think people maybe didn't know how to use it properly. And the green one is we've called it modern hairspray because I'm a big fan of hairspray. Hairspray is the ultimate quick fix and it can do many different things.
I hate hairspray. They just say the word and I don't want that. I'm smelly like an old granny's hair.
And we had the lovely Lynn Harris from Perfumer H, who came to my garden a couple of days. One day it was raining. She went away and formulated the fragrances for us. So we have a very fine fragrance in all of them. So you'll be surprised.
Well, I can't wait to try them. So which one? Look, I've got very thin, fine hair.
I think maybe a little wash of Cool Girl would work.
Cool Girl, really?
Cool Girl, yeah.
Funny that. Okay. And would you add...
Now that's an idea for another product.
Would you add Lazy Girl to that as well?
I don't know, you tell me.
I just think the two sound good.
I'm not sure Cool Girls are lazy, though.
No, you can't afford to be. I just like the combination. No. You know, a Cool Girl deserves to be lazy on a Sunday, doesn't she? And do you think that these will now be the beginning of something for you that's a new departure in your life?
It's been so exciting. It's just been fantastic. The response has been wonderful. They've kind of become cult items that I hear most hairdressers have in their kit. So that has made me very, very happy. And we do have plans to do more, yes.
You've spent most of your working life immersed in a luxury business, really.
I have. I've been very lucky. I've travelled the world. Yes, we've gone to the most luxurious places, but we also have gone to the other side too. So I have seen both sides now, in the words of the old song.
So what, for you, having immersed yourself in all of that luxury and come from a, you know, a great place, but not necessarily a luxurious place, Cumnock.
Well, the luxury was a fish supper on a Friday night, yeah.
That's quite a luxury. Yeah. And of course, the freedom to be feral, which again, this day and age, is you know, not no longer present for a lot of children. But now for you, you know, successful, yeah, you could probably stop working tomorrow. What's your luxury? What's your go-to luxury?
My luxury now, Mariella, is my garden. I have a lovely house with a lovely big garden. The luxury of coming, I've just been in Italy for a week doing multiple shows in multiple cities. And I love doing that, don't get me wrong. I mean, pasta and pizza, I haven't put on a pound, by the way, which is great. The luxury of opening my back door and stepping out into my garden and watching my seeds develop or not, as the case might be this morning. There's nothing for me more luxurious than that.
Well, you haven't brought me a garden or even... even perhaps a bunch of blooms from it. So what have you brought me to show me?
Well, I brought you a picture of my garden.
I'm sorry, but you know what?
I'll send you some.
Bit thoughtless. Let me have a look at the picture though.
I bought this house with a kind of 120-foot long football pitch at the back that was just green with Lalandi in London. So I feel like I'm in the country in London. It's become this sort of heavily planted, colourful through 11 months of the year rectangle in North London, which feels like I'm in the country.
That's an incredible achievement, 11 months of the year.
Yeah.
Well, I have here a picture of your garden, and it really does look glorious. It looks incredibly peaceful. It looks like you can't see another house from it, which is a luxury in itself. If it's going to be your luxury, your garden, what's your favourite season to sit there and drink it in?
I guess my favourite season would be late summer, autumn. You know, spring's great and the tulips grow, it's all kind of brash. Summer sometimes never happens, but that late summer, that sort of, I love dahlias, I love them, and I have hundreds planted, so hopefully the rain's not going to wash them all away, get those slugs going. And I just love those sort of balmy August, September nights and the colours and the insects and the quiet with a book or two.
Oh yeah, that really sounds like backstage in the fashion world.
No, not at all. And no, the other thing is it's solitary. I don't have to speak to anyone. You know, the plants don't have an opinion. It's just me, selfish.
Just finally, we're here in Harrods in the penthouse, which is of course a rather opulent part of the building, though indeed the whole building's pretty opulent, let's face it. Where, if I let you loose, just go crazy in whatever department you want?
Well, I mean, I wonder if the sunglasses department, yeah, but I would probably go much crazier downstairs in the menswear department. I'd probably have a good old rummage round there. Yeah.
Do you like fashion?
I do like fashion, yes.
Well, you're wearing a very nice tank top today, like an old Pringle, isn't it?
It
really
is, but it's from a skate shop in New York, and it looked amazing on the 19-year-old Chinese model who I was working with the other day, girl. Looked fantastic on skinny hair, so I ordered it online straight away, and I look like Jimmy Tarbuck in it. But hey, in a good way, that's fine.
You look like trendy Jimmy Tarbuck. That's all right, isn't
it?
Well,
he once was, wasn't he? You know,
weren't we all? Once were. Thank you very much, Sam.
Thank
McKnight.
You for having me.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you. You've been listening to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guest, Sam McKnight. Next week, I'll be talking to the actor, model, filmmaker, and Harrods' very own poet, Greta Bella Machina. This series is recorded in Harrods in London. Thank you to our sponsor, Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.